Alrighty, well, here we are, another show of Oscar bait, and our guest is going to be very happy today that we're not reading the Variety and Deadline pages for our. we have something a little meatier to talk about here today.
Something worthwhile today, a thing we don't do often.
And you all had some vitamins, so.
I mean, we can switch to Variety if you really want to.
I'll keep it in the background. If we hit a moment, I'll be like, all right, Beetlejuice 3, greenlit. What do we think? First take. Yes, we have Sam Deegan, author, film historian, joining us today. We are so excited. If you own, I think we said this on the last show, we were just like, if you own Blu-rays, you know. Yeah.
You can't escape me. I'm very sorry.
but thank you for joining us. We're very excited.
Yeah, go through your collection right now, everyone listening, and please pull out how many titles you didn't realize has Sam as a commentary on them.
The funniest, also, thank you guys for having me on the show, but to me, the funniest thing that happens is when, like, my friends or family members happen to buy, like, friends who are not movie people happen to buy something that I'm on and will text me like, why are you on this disc? I'm like, you don't understand what I do for work at all, do you?
I mean, I Will knows I'm one to blame. Like, I'm kind of this person that will buy stuff and I just want the movie. Like, I like special features for sure, but like, I have to remember to look at them. And it's funny, like when I look at stuff, it's like I turn over Killing Birds and it's like, oh, there's Sam.
Yeah,
that was one you get a lot of questions about.
That's the one that I have gotten some of the most enthusiastic comments about, which still shocks me because I guess to me, it's like I've spent so much time defending Joe D'Amato that especially the later D'Amato and later 80s Italian horror was so shit on for so long that to have random strangers reach out to me and be like, I loved this commentary. It's like, first of all, why were you watching Killing Birds? Let alone watching it multiple times so that you could watch a commentary.
I mean, we're probably in a small boat here. I do think Killing Birds is one of his better later films, and also one of the better later horror films that come out of Italy. I can swim in that humid atmosphere of that movie. Yep. It's really,
yeah, I love those. They're kind of gross, but they don't take themselves seriously.
Well, maybe at some point we'll all get a chance to talk D'Amato, but that is not today. Right off top, though, we must say November 18th, all three of us, we are going to be at the Music Box Theater, and we are going to be showing Alan Arkin's Little Murders in 35mm. And you could probably guess that Sam is on the Blu-ray for Little Murders.
So, shocking.
Yeah. You can prep before and play that, and then you can come hear it on stage as we talk through that movie. And we're just going to probably talk about the book in general also on stage. Should say Sam is here for her new book, Revolutions in 35mm. That is so cool. You're going to want to check it out. And you're going to have copies too when you're here, right?
I will, yes.
Great. So you can pick up a copy. Sam will sign it for you.
It'll probably say something stupid. I'm really bad at signing things.
Do people ask you to like write an inscription or something?
Yes. And I'm always like, what do you want me to say? Don't forget to change the batteries in your smoke alarms on November 1st.
That's good. Just sign them all. It's good.
I should.
Yeah. One of his many, his many monikers. You sign as Clifford Brown, speaking of how we all met during that insane Jess Franco thing that we put on at Spectacle.
Yeah, I can't believe you guys are still alive.
We made it.
Not just like because you were watching Jess Franco movies all day. It's more being on the Spectacle metal folding chairs all day. That's
Yeah.
Grateful Hall did it with us.
I spent a lot of time walking around the block multiple times.
Sitting on a heating pad.
Yeah. Using the bathroom at that restaurant next door, like getting to know the staff there. They're very sweet staff at that place.
We felt bad.
But, I'm so glad you guys did that, though. You definitely have to come back and do something similar.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're hoping, because the Spectacle crew, thankfully, they were like, that was fun, but we didn't go hard enough at all. So next time, let's really punish everybody. And so we're going to go 80s, 90s, 2000s, Jets.
Hell yeah.
That's right.
Right. Let's see how an audience, they all deal together. Lulu's talking asshole. In a
group. Oh, they're going to love it.
It's a bonding experience, which we all need more of, I think, for the next couple years.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I mean, maybe we can do it around Oscar time, too. Maybe that one scene will really hit.
Yeah, well, we can make a montage of all the times Lena has had sex with Oscar statues. It's quite a few.
You should. You have to make this montage now.
Making a note, actually. Yeah, yep. So get ready, New York. Franco Romania will be coming one day. But before we get to that, we mentioned the show at the Music Box on the 18th. On the 21st, we are going to be across town at the Davis Theater in Lincoln Square. And we are going to be bringing back our dormant blind screening series, Trustfall. Sam is going to join us for that. And if you don't understand what that is, it's a mystery movie. You don't know what it is, but we'll never let you down. We were not that kind of people. Like, we're always there for you. So whatever we're going to show is going to be really cool. And it's very possible, if you're an astute listener with like lines drawn on maps all around your room, if you listen closely, you might be able to guess what it is later on the show today.
Also, if you just go back through this entire show, that movie we've probably talked about more than any other. So you could probably
rightfully so.
Yeah, it comes up a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of like, could we do it?
I mean, we're going to find out how it goes. If there's a riot, just blame me.
Yeah. Don't cancel our series. Hansel, Sam, we didn't want to do this.
And we're forced.
At gunpoint.
Yeah. No, we're very excited. This is going to be one of the probably more exciting blind screenings that we've done. This is, I think we can all agree, this is a 10 out of 10 film. So
10 out of 10. And I have to say, and this might be a clue, but only if you're one of like five people, this film that we're screening uncut screened in New York earlier this year, allegedly uncut, and like half the audience figured, well, maybe not half, probably like a third of the audience figured out within the first 5 minutes that it was not uncut, and we were all mad.
Yeah, no, because that's what kind of spurred this, because we were so sad we weren't in New York for that show, and then we heard immediately after that it was indeed not uncut, so we're like, well, we have to fix it.
Yeah,
I don't. But how do you even make that mistake? Like,
it's pretty.
It's very easy to tell.
You can figure that one out. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to like say too much here.
Yeah, we'll save it for the intro, but let rest assured, if you've come to Trustfall before, you know one of our favorite things to do is spend weeks of our life creating the best possible version of a movie so you can see it in a way you never have. So we put in the work on this one, and it'll be pretty special.
It's such a special movie, and it almost never screens, and it never screens uncut.
Yeah, just be, you know, come with your with a steely nerve for parts of it, because you just got to get through a few parts and then it's a cakewalk.
Don't be cowards.
That's right.
We're in a bold new future. If this is too scary for you, I don't know. Maybe it's nap time, because this is the movie. Both of these movies are kind of what the world could use right now. I mean, these are, yeah.
Yes.
That's true, actually. I've never thought of them as a double feature, but they have some interesting parallels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're living in these worlds right now.
Yeah. Let's not take a depressing turn for the conversation here.
Yeah. So on to the reason you are here and the reason you're coming, which, as John mentioned, is your book, Revolution 35mm. We both really enjoyed this book. So we're very excited to get into it a little bit with you. I guess before John hops in with his first burning topic, just for those who don't know, I just wanted to pull just a little from the introduction, just so people know that I'll just quote it directly, but the focus of this book is on films made during the decades between the Algerian War in the late 50s and the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. And so that is the time span that all the films you talk about and your friends talk about in this book.
Yeah, and we had to, so the starting idea was, okay, I envisioned it as a solo book, and I'm really glad that it ultimately wasn't one. But Andrew, my co-editor, and I were trying to figure out some parameters, because talking about political violence in cinema, it's such a broad topic that to kind of get a book off the ground at all, we had to set some parameters. So like there are very few mainstream movies, almost no documentaries. It's kind of all more marginal cinema made during the Cold War, which in retrospect, I think made a lot of sense. And I'm happy that we cut so many things out.
Is there anything that you are sad you had to lop off, though, that you would maybe try to revisit if you did more in this realm?
Honestly, so we've already had people saying, when are you doing volume two? Because there are There are so many films that could fit that we didn't get to. Like, one of the things that I really wanted to write about, but because of our deadline and our word count limit, I couldn't get to this chapter I wanted to do on Iranian cinema, like Persian cinema before the revolution. And that is something I would really like to include in a, you know, theoretical future volume. Definitely maybe some Abel Ferrara movies.
Ooh, yeah.
Definitely also more South American films. It's like the challenge of having a publisher say yes to a book and then you have to stick to a reasonable word limit, but you're also talking about cinema globally. It's like there's so much. Like, there are definitely more Chinese films that should be in here. There's enough for a second book for sure.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Cause I was reading the chapter, rereading the chapter on the Zapata Westerns. And I just kept thinking, like, the big theme of that is kind of the Western influence coming in and affecting foreign governments. And it made me think there would be so much to write about, I'm sure, for like the Choi Hark Once Upon a Time in China films. And especially those first two films, I feel like deal with, you know, very, very deeply political ideas, Western influence coming in, affecting China, affecting its future. So much so that those two movies reverse their position, I think, in the first. I think the second one, like, it completely flips it on its head.
Yeah. And so this is actually part of the problem, because our main parameter is no mainstream films, because to me, mainstream films feel like propaganda. And Once Upon a Time in China is 100% a propaganda mainstream film. So yeah. It's like if we did a different version of I think it would be really interesting, actually, to do a different version of this book where you look at more mainstream films funded by either countries or big budget studios that have some of these themes accidentally sneak in. Yeah. But with Choi Hark, with a lot of the Hong Kong directors, it's a more complicated case, because it's like if they make a film that's sort of in line with what we are covering in the book, it's almost only category three films that would fit.
Yeah, right. Especially his early career where he was a different filmmaker.
Yes, when he cared less about the following the rules. You could even find a way to include things like Johnny To's Election, and especially Election 2, because they're still too spicy for China.
Yes.
Yeah, so much so that 3 may never come out.
Three is about to go into production.
I've just heard it so much. I don't know if I can have this break on. Is it really?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, but I have heard that 3 is literally going into production like now. Oh, so keep your fingers crossed permanently.
Breaking news.
Just weld them together.
Let me get some Gorilla Glue. Hold on.
Yeah, till we get election three, not allowed to uncross.
No red.
Yeah, I can't die until I can see election three. So,
because I get so sad when I see those interviews with him, and he keeps saying like, "Was gonna do it, can't do it." It's obviously going to be a different movie now because of how things have changed, and he just seems like, you know, that's all he wants to make. I mean, when was the last Johnny Toe film?
Recent. 2019? 2021?
So there was like a 4-year break, right?
Yeah. But he's still pretty active.
Yeah, what was that one? It was kind of like a Running on Karma-esque thing. Chasing Dream, that's right. Chasing Dream. Okay. Yeah.
He still got it, and he still looks better in a suit than any other person alive. I don't know who his tailor is, but I hope he's paying them well.
Yeah. No, he's a dapper man, Mr. Toe. You got to see him recently, didn't you?
I did not get to see him, which I think I was raging to you about. So I had to go to Oregon for a wedding, and like a week after I booked all of my hotels and travel and everything. And of course, like, it's my oldest friend's wedding. Then it gets announced that Johnny Toe's coming to New York. I was like, okay, how much do you want me to be at this wedding? But I was a good friend, and I went to the wedding and just, you know, brought a life-size cutout of Johnny Toe with me as my date.
That's dedication. That's a true friend right there.
Yeah, it's good to know that some of us film freaks are not sickos. So that's good to know that you had a humanist side to you, because that would have been a much moral pull. I don't know. I don't know if I could have come down on the side of good on that one.
I mean, when I got back, so Museum of Modern Art did this 24 film series. When I got back, I made it to 20 out of the 24 films before a cold took me out. So it's like I showed my dedication, even though I do not have that much time in my schedule to go see 20 movies. It was so worth it.
And it was just all Johnny Toe?
Yep. And it was there wasn't any of the really early stuff. I want to say the earliest film was like 91, 92, but a decent chunk of it was on 35 millimeter. And I have never been so delighted to every screening. People would applaud the Milky Way image logo, and it's like just life bringing.
Wow. That is,
yeah, beautiful. That would help a lot to make the world feel better.
Mm-hmm. was there a one in the series that kind of like stood out that you saw again? You were like, oh damn, I think I even like this more.
I mean, probably Vengeance. So I saw Vengeance when it was originally released, and that was when I was like into Hong Kong movies. I knew who Johnny Toe was, but I hadn't seen the majority of them. And I liked it, but was also kind of like, this is kind of quirky and weird. But now that like I'm so absorbed in his style, regardless of what his style of storytelling, regardless of what genre he's in, seeing Vengeance again all those years later, I was like, well, this is perfect.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. That was kind of one of the first Johnny Toes I saw as well, because I think it was like one of the first that was available.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it definitely felt like, am I seeing the right one first? Who's this fucking French guy? Who's this knockoff of Alain Delon or whatever? Because wasn't it they were trying to get Alain Delon to be in the movie and it like didn't
work? I think originally he agreed to be in the movie, or they were in talks, but I think it didn't work out for his schedule, or because he was basically trying to be retired.
Yeah.
But Johnny Halliday is amazing. And, you know, for anyone who doesn't know French pop stars, Johnny Halliday is basically like French Elvis, like one of the coolest people on earth. He's in some spaghetti westerns looking cooler than everyone else in the movie. And he's great in it. And somehow vibes really well with those Johnny Toe regulars like Anthony Wong and Lam Suet, and it just like felt like they had such a good natural kind of dynamic together.
Mm. Yeah, that is one of the kind of beautiful things about Toast Cinemas. It's like Ford, you know, it's those returning people. You see them come back in and you're just like, oh, it's so nice to see you guys. And
Yes, it's like a family reunion.
well, maybe one day we'll go into Johnny Toe at some point a little deeper, but we're getting off topic. Let's get back to the book. There's no toe in the book, not now, maybe in the sequel.
Yes, it's so easy to get off topic. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, you know, this is already more on track than our show usually is, so we're doing okay.
Yeah, this is an us problem. We're not very good at this.
It's not your fault.
Yeah. Will, what were some of your favorite? There was a chapter you were dying to talk about.
I mean, two of my favorites. I really loved the let's see, what's it called? Japanese leftist politics from New Wave to the Pink Film. And then also the chunk on Jalowski and the devil as well. Yes, that is it's hard to say, but that is definitely top three for me of his films, I think.
That's amazing. I never, like, once you meet people who least know him enough to have seen something beyond Possession, it always fascinates me, like, what are his films that people are resonating with, because they're difficult films. But The Devil is just like another really big struggle that I had with this book was I knew so. Matt, my friend Matt, who's this professor, he's like a Soviet history leftist politics professor in Pennsylvania. He wrote this chapter about the Yugoslavian Black Wave. And like I knew going in that that chapter had to be in the book, but I knew that I was going to be covering some of the other Eastern European, like Soviet era cinema. And narrowing that list down was so hard. Like, excluding Miklos Jankso, this Hungarian director was difficult, but it's like I've worked on some Jankso releases, and I feel like his name is more known for that type of thing than Zhuavsky. And I don't think people see Zhuavsky as a political filmmaker, even though Possession is like set at the fucking Berlin Wall and kind of has to do with these spies. And his first two films are explicitly political, about political resistance. So I was like, okay, I'm going to put this in here and I feel good about this choice.
Yes, no, I'm very happy you did as well, because I don't think enough people talk about the rare times we do get horror-ish films that are also so fiercely political, and you know, not just like a little bit. So, very happy that that was in there.
Yeah, I got to screen The Devil. So I've been doing some book-related screenings over the last like month or two on the East Coast, and I got to screen The Devil at this anarchist space in New York called Woodbine. And sorry, I'm not expecting any kind of delivery, so I don't know what the hell that is. I'm just going to ignore it.
We can make this an unboxing episode if we.
Yes, it's the ghost of Zhuavsky is at my apartment. But it was amazing because most of the people there hadn't seen anything beyond Possession. And I got to do an intro and talk all about the political history, which is really complicated and I think makes it harder to understand the film if you don't know anything about Poland in the 1800s. And like, why would you if you grew up in the US and you're not Polish? But we had this this like Q&A slash discussion afterwards, and people asked so many good questions that it made me even happier that I included it in the book. When I was like, is this, does this really fit? But now I'm like, okay, it does.
But yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting process of cutting that, because yeah, you're right. I mean, Yantros makes like so much sense. That's the most political ass dude in the long, you know. But hey, there's book two. You can fit his long takes into book two, you know. I'd love to see what you guys come up with for about Red Song, because that's easily one of my favorite films.
So. Oh, it's so good. Yeah, I don't know that we actually are doing a book two, so I shouldn't keep talking about it, but...
It can happen.
Look, everyone listening and everyone that comes to the shows, make sure it's out of stock everywhere online and you just sell to every single one that you bring, then maybe we can say that it's a guarantee. Maybe not, but...
I mean, working on this book was such a great experience, and books are can be very challenging. Sometimes the challenging part is in writing them. Sometimes the challenging part is in dealing with the publishing company and the promo afterwards and getting people to pay attention to it. But in this case, it's just been, I would say, probably the best experience I've had with any of the books I've worked on. So it's like, I'm not opposed to doing a second one. It just... putting this together was a little exhausting, so I think I might need a minute.
Yeah, take a little break. Do you this is not your first book. Do you find it, obviously it's a very different process. Do you have a preference as far as your own workflow, doing something solo and something that involves so many other people?
I much prefer doing solo books because doing these edited anthologies, theoretically, like when you start out, you're like, oh, this will be so much less work if everyone else is writing a chapter. That is not correct. And editing is challenging because, like, I actually love editing, but what makes it difficult is, like, I tend to be a pretty rigorous editor. And I've definitely worked with people in the past who were not, like, some people do not handle edits well. And even if you're trying to point out, like, all I'm doing is correcting your grammar. I think the main thing that's hard to understand is when you're doing a collection like this, you need to have a consistency with tone. So it's like everybody's writing about different kinds of films, but you can't have people using wildly different approaches to style and grammar. It's like, it's not as rigid as an academic book, but it's not a zine. Like, it's a book that needs to have cohesion, and that takes a long time.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm sure just trying to even write anything about Italy at that time, it's like, how can you cram all this information in with what's going on with the Years of Lead and Gladio, Stay Behind missions, all it's just like, it's such a hotbed of just, you know, absolute craziness going on in Italy at that time. And it's, you know, I'm impressed what was condensed into there because you can't, the whole book's not about Italy.
It could easily have been.
Yeah, no, really. Yeah.
We reached a point where we were like, all right, we can't do any more fucking chapters about Italy. And then I was like, but wait, I have to do an essay on Elio Petri. Otherwise I will be struck by lightning and killed by the ghost of John Maria Volante.
Yeah, if there's one person you don't skip right now, yeah, it's probably
no.
You. Yeah, no, I mean, that was one of my favorite chapters in the book, because that's just, there's a guy that's really only starting to get, I think, more of a mainstream attention now because Radiance and certain people are putting out the Blu-rays of these movies. And I guess Arrow did Property is No Longer Theft a long time ago, but...
They did.
Yeah, but still, it's nice to see more of them come out. And
yeah, somebody... And I'm wondering if maybe I can push someone to make this happen in the next year or two, but someone needs to do a retrospective. I don't know how hard that would be, because some of the later films, like Tato Motto, which is fucking insane. If you've never seen it, I can't imagine how an audience would react to John Maria Volante and Marcello Mastroianni as these, like, sinister priests and Christian politicians who have these scenes together for half the movie where they're so close. I don't know how their tongues aren't in each other's mouths. It's a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece, but truly one of the most bizarre films.
It's weirder than The Devil, I think.
No, totally. Yeah. Much weirder. What Devil?
Which is saying something.
The Devil looks positively, like, you know, normal compared to that one. But yeah. Oh, that would be, see, that would be,
let's put that in a trust fall.
I was going to say, that's such a good movie to spring on a motherfucker. Just like,
oh my God, you need to give a solid intro, but I don't know. I just, there's something about it that I need to watch it again to understand why I love it so much, but it just does something that not a lot of other filmmakers do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd coming from him, I will say that, because if you're watching, you know, you're watching along and then you get to that, you're like, what just exploded in this man's mind?
Yeah, it, not that his other films don't have sexual tension or this sense of like some kind of tension is simmering, like the sense of anxiety is in all of his movies, but in that one it goes in a weird direction that
mm-hmm.
He's one of the best.
Let's talk about something we were almost going to do. This could be fun. We were going to, I think we had talked about originally doing Sergio Martino's Silent Action.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Sergio Martino is one of those directors who I think has always been so unappreciated. And in recent, like growing up, when people that I knew who were really into like American horror started getting into Italian horror movies and giallo films, it was always all about Argento, Bava, a little bit about Fulci. I mean, he didn't really make that many giallo films, but like Sergio Martino, I think in the last maybe decade he's like finally starting to get recognition for those giallo movies, but it's also like he made crime movies too, guys.
Like, or probably more crime movies, I think.
Yeah, same thing with Lindsay.
Yeah. Oh God, Lindsay made so many crime movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With we were lucky enough when he came to Chicago last year to spend some time with Martino.
Oh, so jealous.
Oh my God. He was a fucking angel. Like, I thought I was going to pass out because there was one point where he just pulled out his phone and he was just like, do you want to see my house? I'm like, sure, whatever you want. So he's just showing me this like beautiful villa. And then he's scrolling through and Edwidge pops up.
Just oh my God. He goes,
yes, we got lunch the other day. Isn't she still beautiful? I was like, holy shit. Okay.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, no, just insane. But then I was like, can we, I'm sorry if you don't like them as much as I do, but I'd love to talk to you about your sex comedies and how you met Marty Feldman and like all of that. And he got so excited. We had a great time. But the best part at the end, he said, do you know my best movie? And I said, well, I mean, paused and don't want to ruin that, obviously. And he says to me, he was like, La Bellissima Estate is my best.
Wow.
Movie. Yes.
Never would have guessed that.
No, he said it's the best cinematography I've ever done. And the acting is the best that I ever directed. And it's beautiful. And I was like, wow, okay. And if people listening haven't seen it, that is his coming of age film about his life growing up. And it's, you know, I would say atypical from what you would expect normally from Martino, but that's his most favorite of his movies.
But that, I think, is something that is really frustrating, because with Martino, this idea that most people have that his giallo films or the violent crime films is like, that's typical Martino, but he directed films in so many different genres that like the horror movies don't dominate that. I'm also sitting, I'll have to show you when we're done recording, because if I move my computer, I feel like I'm going to rip some cables out, but I'm sitting right in front of this giant Subway poster of All the Colors of the Dark. So it feels very appropriate.
Yeah. I mean,
I look at Edwidge all the time.
Hopefully we're looking at Edwidge sooner than later. Oh wait, should I cut that?
It's fine. No. Just beep it. Just beep
okay.
It.
Okay. Yeah, she might.
Amazing.
Very exciting. All right. That was a very long beep, everyone. What could we have been talking about? Was it offensive things being said, or was it something we don't want you to hear?
I confessing that I bought Edwidge feet pics off of Sergio Martino?
Was. Yep.
He might have haggled. He was in a very... Because when I tried to like get a little alone time with him, I was asking him about Silent Action and he just kept sitting there like on his phone. And I was like, oh God, I'm boring him. I'm talking about something he doesn't want to talk about. And he was like, the Wi-Fi in here? And I was like, oh yeah, it's this. And he was like, I'm not getting a connection. And I was like, okay, well, anyway, I have a question. He's like, are you sure this is the password? And he was so concerned with the Wi-Fi. So I was like, you know what? We'll save it. No big deal.
I also sometimes wonder if when you've made as many films as he has, like Do you remember all the details about all of them?
He did. Very much.
Really?
So. When he was also what's the name of his fucking Mondo movie? Naked and Violent.
I like Naked and Violent.
He was talking about that in one of the Q&As and also after it. And he talked about he talked about smoking weed with the Rolling Stones while he was in the States.
What?
And then just went on this crazy, like, just talking about everything. And he's like, that's when I fell in love with Chicago. And like all that. He remembers everything from every movie. Like,
it was incredible.
Very, very. It was. There were some like sad moments, because definitely once his wife passed away, that really, you know, that really hurt him. And you can tell it's definitely, you know, it affected his brain for sure. But as far as like details of his work, that's all still very sharp. So
amazing.
Yeah. He did return to tell me about, after he got the Wi-Fi figured out, he did return to tell me about the street shootout scene. And I was like, okay, I was just curious about that. And he's interesting. But you know that what you said about, you know, how his career and a lot of these Italian people, and you know, a lot of them are mentioned in your book. It is funny with Italian cinema how much people get pigeonholed into their genres, because it's like Fulci. I mean, yeah, the back half of his career is pretty dominated by horror, but how many fucking, you know, okay, middling
Franco and Ciccio movies? Yeah.
Did you get to go, Sam, when they, because I think it was Exhumed Films that when Harry found that print of Whistler's?
I did not go to that because I was in New York and I'm sad I missed it.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the better of those early.
Yeah. And they're not great.
No.
But no. I am glad that you told Martino that you like his sex comedies, because I think Italian sex comedies are maybe the like among people who like cult cinema, I feel like it's the most misunderstood genre. Everybody I know for the most part fucking hates them, and I think they're so funny. It's like, what?
Me too.
And we fight on this.
Like, yeah, we do. John and I fight on that sometimes. Yeah, basically like Italian sex comedies in Hong Kong.
I was going to say, there's like a pipeline from one to the other, though.
There really is. I mean, I don't know what it is. I can tolerate the goofiness of a Chinese comedy, but sometimes those 60s ones, you know, it's some things date horribly.
Oh, yeah. And comedy in general, I think, doesn't age particularly well unless it's physical comedy. So it's like, because there are so many topical references usually in there.
Yeah.
But there is, like, Martino does have some good physical comedy in his, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Marty Feldman is, it's like the master of line delivery, but also just like his, even if he's not doing like overt Chaplin style physical comedy, just like his demeanor, it's.
Yeah. His shoulders, like he does more with his shoulders than most supposed comedians like do with everything they have.
Shoulders and eyebrows, like, damn.
Oh, he also, when I asked him about that one in particular in Feldman, John, I can't even remember who was gonna direct it.
But Giovanna Longthighs, right?
Yeah. Wait, is that I get them crossed?
I sometimes get them crossed too. It's been a few years.
Let's see.
It's good podcast material here. Yeah.
Just put some Jeopardy music in.
I just asked him how it happened with meeting Marty Feldman, and he said he was in Italy working on something, and someone gave him a screenplay that someone else, I think he fucking said, I can't remember, another Italian director, but he was like, someone else was supposed to make. And Marty Feldman, we met each other, and he told me he had this screenplay that was terrible, but it could be good. And so he gave it to me and I fixed it. And then we made it.
Yeah. What?
Wow. Snaked the film away from someone else. Yeah. Good for you, Sergio.
Oh, we love this. They don't give a shit.
Well, I think some of it, and I do think there are a lot of parallels between the Italian film industry in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and the Hong Kong film industry in the 70s and 80s and 90s, is they were all kind of working together on overlapping projects so often, and they all made so fucking many films that I think if something got taken away from you, it wasn't as big of a deal as someone who thought of themselves maybe as more of an auteur director, because I don't think any of them did. It was just like, we're doing these projects.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, I don't think probably anybody, save for maybe Argento, ever considered himself probably outside of that. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. Well, he's another case.
Yeah, we don't have to go into Argento today. But I, you know, I think it is really interesting that, yeah, they both those industries have a disregard for animal life at the time.
Sure, there's that too.
Yeah. If you want to see Calamity of Snakes, you want to really just watch brutality unfold. But, you know, I mean, like, they do. Yeah. I mean, that's probably why. I mean, I'm sure we're all in agreement that films of those eras from those countries are just, I mean, some of the best. I mean,
And for sure.
There's something to be said for working in sort of that environment like that. And I don't know exactly what the one-to-one is, what makes it over, but maybe as we're talking, it's making me think like maybe it is like a kind of, you're devoid of ego when you're in that system.
Well, also I think, and I don't know why this just popped into my head, but a year or two ago, I was listening to this Donnie Yen interview where people were asking him about the process of working on the last John Wick movie and like how long did that take to choreograph and rehearse, and he looked at them like, what are you saying? He was like, we just did it, we just went in and did it. It's like, what? But I feel like people don't always appreciate that outside of Hollywood, a lot of the time other studio systems or national systems, you don't have a long time to make a film. So you just have these really specifically trained professionals who are just like crashing cars all day, every day. And that's what they do. And, or, you know, kicking people in the face or, yeah. Or murdering turtles.
Yeah. No, it helps when, you know, a lot of these people were brutalized through the Peking opera school and it burned into them. Like, Yeah. Let's jump across the pond real quick to a neighbor. Let's go to Japan.
My other favorite.
I hope this isn't too heartbreaking to all three of us, because we did want to do some Japanese stuff, but
I know.
Yeah. Yes.
It's so hard to license.
We got close with some, but it's just too, it's a prickly. Well,
I'll come back. I feel like if we could figure something out next year and have more time to try to get these things going, I think Japanese exploitation films, pink films, even some of the more transgressive new wave movies, it's not that there isn't an audience. I think they just require a certain amount of presentation. Like, you need to warn people before they watch a Koji Wakamatsu film. Like, with no context, it's just like, I'm gonna need to talk to the manager and have someone canceled. But they're also expensive to license, and like getting actual prints is a pain, and you know.
Yeah.
We'll just cast a net to everyone here and say, in the next 12 months, tell us when we can do it.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, because it really is a world waiting for a lot of people that is, I think, way more applicable to like what people's modern interests are. I mean, so many Japanese movies, just if you don't listen, if the sexual violence and everything else is too much, they all look fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think is really hard to understand for especially a lot of Americans, because we're so used to these low budget exploitation movies being made by people who are just like scraping this film together with the skin of their teeth. Like, they have no budget. They don't probably in a lot of cases, sometimes they did, but they often don't have a lot of technical experience. And these Japanese pink films and the exploitation movies, it's like they're made by guys who trained under Kurosawa and Ozu and Mizoguchi. And they're like, hugely important filmmakers going on to train people who are going on to make some of the most beautiful films of all time that also happen to be really nasty sex films. Yes. It's perfect. It's like, what more could you want out of life?
Yes, everything you need for movies.
Yeah, I've always, yeah, I feel like I've noticed that a lot more people I know who are not like very big into Japanese films certainly don't, you know, go into the Roman porno genre or the pink genre. Like, I've noticed a lot more people talking about like female scorpion or female prisoner scorpion. And I'm wondering what that is, because it's like there was those awful Blu-rays that Arrow put out, which we don't need to get into the how they fucked the color scheme up so poorly. But like, you know,
mad. That was so long ago.
You want them. It's just like, if you're an internet person, if you're a Patreon person, maybe there's a custom colored version out there that it looks pretty good. But
is there another color?
We'll send you the first two.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, they look awesome.
Wow, it's like Christmas.
Yeah. Yep. The third one I don't think has been done yet, but
I don't remember. We'll check on that.
I think the third one, from what I remember from that Arrow set, the first two have a much more exaggerated color palette and it's easier to fuck up. Whereas the third and fourth ones are much more kind of dark gothic looking. Like, not that you can't fuck those up, but the second one with all those leaves, the like those sequences, when those colors are screwed up, you can tell.
Yeah. Yes.
Looks terrible. Looks like Beetlejuice 2 type shit. It's like, there's this poor man's Baba here. Those movies are so dependent on their color and mood and the sound that it is. Yeah, you're right. I guess the third one is a little closer, like his like Curse of the Dog or the God Dog sort of stuff. Like,
yeah.
Well, hopefully we're able to bring some of these. If you were to address someone who said, listen, I want to get into these movies, I'm a little squeamish towards the sexual violence that seems pretty prevalent, what would you say to offer context to maybe why it is that way, or a way into not having that be the thing that brings down your experience while watching it?
I really struggle with finding a good answer to this question because part of the problem with this type of Japanese cinema is almost every single one of those scenes, almost every single one of those films involve at least one rape scene. And like, case in point, usually every September, October, I'll try to watch a bunch of new to me horror movies. No time to do that this year because I was married to Johnny Toe, but last year I watched exclusively Japanese horror movies and it almost felt like my captain's log was like day 87, someone else got raped in a movie. It's like every single movie has it. And it doesn't bother me. So I think I especially have trouble with like how to contextualize it. But I think in the case of Japanese cinema, it's important to remember that these studios, by and large, especially when you're talking about these 60s, 70s, 80s films, they're not going for realism. They have this approach like, this is a fantasy. This is not something that we're trying to make realistic, but they are pretty graphic. And I think if you can approach it as, these are meant to be really over-the-top fantasy films, then I think it's a little bit easier to get used to. I would say the same thing is true of Hong Kong Category 3 films, where it's like they are intentionally over-the-top on purpose. And if you're someone who just like can't handle seeing any sexual violence on screen, then these films are not for you for the most part. But I think if you start with the female comic Scorpion series, it's a little bit easier because they are so beautiful. And like, I think all of them are beautiful. Like pretty much every single Japanese film I've ever seen is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But with Meiko Kaji in particular, I think she's a little bit more of an easy access point for people because she has such an incredible screen presence, and she always plays these really strong characters. And when I've tried showing these kinds of films to other women, especially who don't like horror movies, or maybe they like horror comedies or lighter things, I feel like she's a good grounding kind of jumping off point, because often the thing you have to remember in some of these Japanese exploitation movies is even when the female characters are raped or assaulted, they don't give a fuck. It's like it's not something that's fucking up their day. It's just like, okay, well, now there's another person on my list that I have to murder. And there's something like kind of cathartic about it, because when someone is raped in a Hollywood movie, it's treated like this is the worst thing that can ever happen to you. You're never coming back from this. You're damaged. And in these Japanese movies, it's like there are so many things in society that are violent and damaging. This is just one thing on the list. And so that kind of equalizing quality, I think, makes it easier to adjust to, if that makes sense.
I agree. And I think even 2 points jumping off that, I mean, one, like you mentioned, the female prisoner scorpion, that first one, I mean, there's the scene in where she's explaining how she was betrayed by her lover.
And it's so beautiful.
It's that
the Japanese flag.
I mean, and that's the, you know, it's hard to say like they're rape scenes, but they're beautiful.
But they are.
They are. They are.
And they're not, they're usually not. And this, I feel like what I'm about to say, there are exceptions, but often, unless you're watching one of the Roman porno films from Nikatsu or one of the more extreme Eroguro movies, in general, the rape scenes are not meant to be erotic. They're meant to be transgressive, and they're meant to be a catalyst for violence. So it's not like the directors are glorifying it, if that helps anyone. I mean,
you can tell the ones that glorify it. You know what
you
I mean?
You for sure
like,
can.
Yeah. Like there's a pretty clear delineation. Yeah. Between like, this is erotic to us. Because so my next question is going to be is, what extent do you think that, especially the ones that are not erotic, and even with like Chinese cinema in category 3, what extent these extreme things a pushback against the culture at that time?
Oh, and I think that's absolutely what it is in both cases, because especially if you think about Japanese cinema and how conservative gender roles were, you have this like huge, and this is happening all over the world in that period, but specifically in Japan, it's like the country is going through these extremely dramatic social changes in the 40s and 50s. And so by the time you get to the 60s and 70s, you have these films that are pushing back against these conservative traditional gender roles, especially for women. And so I think that's why we get all these Sukeban, biker gang, girl movies, which I feel like watching those movies growing up in the US, to me, it was like, oh, these are incredible. I love them. But they're just movies. But it's like, oh, no, there are actual Japanese motorcycle girl gangs that these movies are pulling from because they're real. So it is, I do think it's very much about protest and resistance and pushing back against conservative gender roles, which I think is why you see so much transgressive sexuality in these films. And it's not just men who are perpetrating that. They're, even with the Roman pornos, they almost always end with the woman being like, well, you tried to victimize me. Now I'm going to tie you up and peg you. So enjoy that.
Yeah. I mean, and since you brought up Abel Ferrara earlier, I think there's a great connection you can make there with like Miss 45 and how that movie utilizes it. Because I've always felt that was very in alliance with kind of that approach from a lot of those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think especially with Miss 45, Zoe's involvement is so important as kind of a co-creator of that character. And of course, she would go on to write Bad Lieutenant. And so it's the people wringing their hands about these exploitation movies with sexual violence. It's like, I get it. And I understand that it can be hard to watch if you're not like well-versed in this area of cinema. But it's often more complicated than it seems and is often doing way more interesting things than it might first appear to be.
Oh, I totally agree, because it's like Miss 45, what it's dealing with that is way more interesting and oddly less exploitive and, you know, icky than say like a prestige thing out of Hollywood, like The Accused. You
Oh my God, yes.
know what I mean? Like there's a, it's very, you know, it's funny where people choose to point the blame.
Oh, I mean, I would even argue that Ms. 45 is less offensive than something like fucking Pretty Woman, where it's just like the worst depiction of sex work in probably cinema history. It's just so disgusting.
Pretty Woman made the world a worse place, and I rarely say that about movies.
It absolutely did. Thank you for agreeing. Because sometimes people look at me like, what's wrong with Pretty Woman? I'm like, where should I start?
Absolutely, an absolutely vile, rotten film on the inside. You know, with people wringing their hands about Anora, just take a moment to revisit Pretty Woman.
But it was her first day as a sex worker.
When she gets that jewelry box snapped on her, it's so cute.
Oh.
That's great. She gets paid less with that lump sum than she would have if it was hourly. It's wonderful. It's all just good. All just good. All just good stuff all around.
Love making sex workers fall in love with me. You know, like you don't need this.
No, let me rescue
Rescue you. Look at all these movies I have. We can watch movies forever.
Oh, God. Yeah, see, it's so hard for me to explain to people that, like, you could put all kinds of sexual violence in your movie, and if it serves a particular purpose, I will not be offended. Whereas those kinds of really disgusting tropes around women and heterosexual relationships and sex work, I find that I like get actually mad and offended. So.
Well, those are more nefarious, you know? They're truly sneaking into the system, whereas these other movies are living it loud, you know? It's like, try to
Yeah,
make
they're still in.
yeah, and with the Japanese movies, I feel like you're all kind of in the fantasy together for 90 minutes or whatever it is. And it's, I think that was clear to audiences at the time.
Yes. Have you seen, sorry, one, I just want to ask about it because I just watched it recently. Have you seen Rape 13th Hour?
No.
Holy shit.
What year?
The Sato film.
Oh, Sato is someone that I've been falling kind of in love with, but I haven't seen 13th Hour.
That's not him though. That's not
Oh,
him.
it's not him.
Thought that was him.
Yeah, Hasebi. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes, because I had just watched, let's see, what started it?
I want to say I just watched a different Yasuhara Hasebe film. Trying to
There's
remember what
also
it
so many
is.
with the title rape in them, so it's hard to.
Yeah, they're all kind
Yeah,
of.
there's one just called Rape, but yeah,
I was
Rape.
gonna say there is a movie that's literally just called Rape.
Yeah, this one's 1977, and it absolutely floored me. The style and tone of this movie, like as soon as it starts, you know, it's not that there aren't others like it necessarily, but the way this movie kicks off is this group of gangster dudes who are just in this weird gay polycule are trying to hunt down this man. And the man they're trying to hunt down, all he does every day is forces another man who has a crush on those men to rape women, to break into their homes and rape them. And it's so
It's
beautiful.
it
Like,
sounds amazing. And my so like going down these pink film rabbit holes, if you start watching them and logging them on Letterboxd, I feel like at this point I'm now following enough people who are like giving movies with the most insane titles 4 stars, and they're like, how is this so beautiful? And I'm one of them, but it just when you try to describe the plots to people, it makes you sound like a terrible person.
that's why I also wanted to do that here. I can't really talk about that with very many people, so I appreciate
No.
you. You
No,
know,
and
like, I don't
Hasebe
know.
is great. He's a great director and has definitely he went from like pinky violence to full-on pink films. And apparently, not only does he have a film called Rape 13th Hour and a film called Rape with an exclamation point, but a film called Raping with an exclamation point. It's like,
I have not
dude.
seen.
If you haven't been paying attention.
But Japanese cinema across the board, maybe Italian cinema comes close. They have the best movie titles. And so for him to, it's like he just gave up and was like, you know what? I'm not even going to try to come up with one of these cool titles. I'm just going to tell you what's happening here.
Yeah, there's also one I haven't watched it yet, but there's another one that's called Secret Honeymoon Assault Train.
Yeah.
I think I actually just downloaded that.
look at us. We're all, I just downloaded, he didn't do this, but I literally just downloaded something called MILF Hunting in the Sea of Trees.
Wow. See, that's an incredible title, In the Sea of Trees.
I just want to see him hunt these MILFs in the suicide forest, please.
Well, also, if anyone's listening, though, and you guys do follow these kind of films.
Everyone has stopped listening and has blocked your podcast by this point.
But wait, we'll full circle it, because he did do Grudge Song in the cycle, and also Black Tie Killers.
So which is so fun.
You can start with Hasebe in a different area, and Stray Cat Rock as well. You can start there before you just start watching the ones called Rape if you want. So
yeah.
But that's what's or you saying. Can alternate.
Right. That's what's fun. Yeah.
I think that's what you were saying, Sam. Like, these people come out of much more prestigious, like socially accepted schools of filmmaking and then go into that. And I think one thing I will say, just to some people who are like, what the fuck? These people are talking about rape and raping. The interesting thing about these movies is not so much the rape. Usually what happens in these movies, these atmospheres are so wholly only that. Like, I think of like Roger Watkins. I mean, we've talked about this.
Yes.
But absolutely. Our depressing atmospheres. And I don't know. I mean, you don't get them anywhere else.
Yeah. There was one that I watched kind of recently that I absolutely need everyone on, and I'm guessing you probably have both seen it. Let me just try to remember the damn title. It's basically, it's like if Suspiria was a pink film, and it's set at this ballet school, and it's just so incredibly beautiful. But that's the thing that I think is really important about these movies, is like the sexual violence isn't the important part. The important part is usually the beauty, the atmosphere, but you also often have characters being put into these, like, I would maybe call them antisocial situations, where they're being forced to step outside of polite, really scripted and structured Japanese social behaviors that are acceptable. So people are just like going buck wild in all kinds of different ways. And there's this real sense of like the carnivalesque in a lot of them. Like, people get forced to go to orgies and then realize like, oh, this is actually my true calling. It's like people go through these like life-changing experiences because of the sex in these films. And it's not always just gross and scary and violent. It's often kind of liberatory as well.
Yeah, that's why Rape 13th Hour as well, a big part of it is just about this closeted man working at this like little gas station, you know, mechanic shop, who's forced by this other man to rape women when he just wants to be with the gay gangsters. And it's really like, it's beautiful.
Okay, the movie I was thinking of is Sex Hunter.
Oh yes,
I love Sex Hunter.
Wait, isn't that also Hasebe?
No, that's
that's our the boy guy.
Did Mermaid.
Yeah.
Oh, Ikeda. That's who. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. No, I mean that one. And what's it? Red Porno.
Yes.
One of my absolute favorites. Oh.
That's okay. You guys are gonna have to come on my show and do a pink film episode with me, because I feel like there's just no one you can ask and not sound deranged. We're going to do a double feature of rape and raping. Would you like to be a guest?
You found the right people.
Yeah, don't put this on while anyone else is in your apartment. Just
no.
Through it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we should do that. That would be awesome. And I think one thing, kind of what we were saying there about the atmosphere, is I think just to close with the idea of exploitation cinema, if you're still if you're still not sure you want to listen, I get it. If you're still nervous, that's fine. But exploitation films, and I'm sure you could speak more to this, Sam, those salacious things like rape, sex, violence, those are all the things that get those movies made basically in those markets. Mm-hmm. Help get them through the door. And the best artists find ways to do other things around that.
Oh, totally. Like, even if you think about like the director's company films in the 1980s, early 1990s in Japan, they basically had this arrangement where, like a typical Pink film, you're getting funding because you're agreeing to include a certain number of sex scenes, a certain number of minutes of nudity. But beyond that, you could do whatever the fuck you want. And so the director's company people they made some of the most beautiful, emotionally impacting films of the 1980s from any country. But I think people ignore them because they are just sort of written off as sex films. But like somebody like Bamei Takahashi, I think people are starting to become familiar with Door, which is like an unusual but amazing home invasion movie. But Door 2 is about these teenage, early 20s. I'm not sure exactly how old they're supposed to be. I think they're supposed to be like late teens. These sex workers who often have sadomasochistic inclined clients, but the movie is actually about female friendship. It's like, it doesn't make any sense when you think about traditional movies, but it like, I don't even know. They're just, I'm in awe.
Yeah. Door 2 is fucking incredible.
It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, all three doors, I'll open all of them.
Good work.
I'll
go ahead.
I was just going to say, on that note, if that's piquing your interest, hopefully I get this out today. On Saturday, we're going to be at the Leather Archive Museum in Chicago showing Tokyo Decadence.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yes, we're very excited about that. We're very happy they want to work with us there.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and they already invited us to come back next year. We won't say the film yet, but let's just say we get to show a Metzger movie finally. So that
I know what it is.
Yeah, you know what it is. Yeah. I'm going to beep it, but you know what it is.
I'm not going to say what it is right now while we're recording, but we'll that's incredible.
So maybe if things work out, you'd be able to join us for one of those, because I'm sure you'd have her. More than we would have to on stage.
Yeah, I do love coming to Chicago, and I do love Radley Metzger.
Yep. Well, we just make it all happen. Radley Metzger and
Pink Films.
Name we said earlier that we'll keep beeping, and then Pink Films. We do it all at once. It'll be beautiful.
I have an idea about that.
If it's the Radley Metzger film, I think it is. It kind of feels like a Pink film.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes, it does. It's got all the things we just talked about.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, we know you're very busy, so we won't keep you. But I guess just to bring it back around one more time to the book, for people who are interested in this kind of thing, the book does a great job of giving you slices that are actually, you know, actually worth chewing on, that will get you interested in all these different areas. So I would say don't be intimidated, you know, because I think some people get nervous when they start about doing like political cinema things. People feel stupid. I mean, myself.
Yeah.
But people feel stupid, you know, like, and not able to access it. I think this book is a great way to begin that, and gives you a lot of great films to start with, you know, whether it's Yugoslav Black Wave or Pink Films or whichever of the million things that are in there. It's a really beautiful way, I think, to let yourself start exploring that world, and you don't have to feel stupid. It's okay. Sam and friends take care of you in the book.
Thank you. I feel like that's one of my biggest aims, is to kind of take films that seem obscure or unapproachable for whatever reason and make them more accessible, because there's just so much great cinema that doesn't take an obvious approach to politics. And I think I personally get more out of films and the politics of a film when they don't beat you over the head with it or do something super obvious and really make you think about things more.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a difference between these movies and something like Don't Look Up, you know,
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Bit like that. I'm just, but, you know, most normal listeners are going to think that's political.
Yeah.
Remember when Christian Bale looked like Dick Cheney?
It was Although,
oh, my God. Have you guys seen Rumors yet?
I just watched it this morning, actually.
I just saw it last night, and it is like I've been feeling like most Americans pretty awful since last Tuesday. And it was the first time that I was like, yeah, OK, maybe I don't have to take this as seriously. Like, we can laugh about it a little bit.
I agree. Leave it to Guy Maddin, you know, to come in and help us out still to this day.
Still,
I was worried to start it because I was like, I don't want to, you know, I haven't loved the last couple as much as I usually do, I would say.
But this one,
you're back in good hands. You'll like it, John. It'll help your soul feel better.
They're masturbating bog mummies, yeah. And there's a giant brain in the woods. So,
okay, yeah. Never mind. I could maybe put that on today.
Yeah, no, it's like when Udo Kier came to the Music Box and masturbated on stage when he was talking about working with Guy Maddin. He didn't actually masturbate, but he pretended and then did the whole thing though. Do you remember that, John? It was like 3 minutes.
He would have if maybe he'd had a little more of the drink that night. Yeah, he might have.
He was wasted, but he came for you. So if you like when Guy Maddin does amazing weird sex jokes, we're back with Rumors.
And the hero of the film is a Canadian. Yeah. Importantly.
All right. Now that we have that available, we got that new Kiyoshi Kurosawa. I guess I got myself a little.
Oh, it's so good.
Which one are we talking about?
The new Kiyoshi Kurosawa Chime.
There's three.
There's three?
There's Chime, Cloud, and he remade Serpent's Path.
Yeah. What? Where have I been? All I've seen is Chime.
You've been at the Johnny Toe screenings.
That's true.
But they are all
so good.
Excellent. I watched Serpent's Path as well this morning because I'd seen Cloud and Chime, but this motherfucker, three in the same year. It's
crazy. Wow. He gives me hope.
Oh,
he really does.
Yeah. So when people ask me, like, do you like any new filmmakers at all? And the answer is like, yes, I do sometimes, or any filmmakers still making films. It's like, well, there's Kiyoshi Kurosawa. You can't argue with him.
Yeah. I mean, what a blessing that there's three in 1 year. I mean, Chime, which is just great. I haven't watched Cloud yet, but I'm hearing great things. But to remake Serpent's Path, like.
Yeah, I won't spoil it, but it's a quite a interesting choice. They decided to remake his own movie and what he did.
That's exciting.
This is hope that we're giving the right people money. So, yeah, instead of Xavier Dolan or whoever the fuck we're giving money to.
Coming back again?
Oh, he's coming back.
No way.
I was so happy the day he was like, I'm retiring. And I was like, thank God.
You're great. Everyone miss you a lot. Yeah.
And then the next day he's like, I changed my mind. And it's like,
is he Mario?
He's Borat.
No, it'll be cool. He'll make another like a shitty impersonation of an Almodovar movie. I can't wait. It'll be awesome.
No. Okay. Anyway, Kiyoshi Kurosawa.
We'll stay on the happy track. We're happy about Chris. We're happy about Guy Maddin. We're happy about the screenings coming up. Things are good.
Yes, things are good.
These are great, and they're going to be great. And we're going to. You want to hear more of us talk? You can hear us keep yammering on stage this coming week. So we'll just remind you, November 18th at the Music Box, Little Murders, 35mm. It's going to rock.
Donald Sutherland's finest 5 minutes on screen.
Holy shit. Greatest one.
And that's all right. Yeah. No.
That's all right.
If I started thinking about this is why we couldn't talk about Little Murders, because I can just go on about Little Murders all day. So we'll talk about Little Murders. Maybe we'll dip into where the hell Fire Sale is in this world. And then Thursday, November 21st at the Davis, our blind screening series. Come see it. We're going to have so much fun getting into some cool stuff. And the more you support it, we can come back and do a gigantic Pinku Festival.
Yay.
So come out. Any last words you'd like to, do you want to run through deadline real quick or are you good?
I'm good. Okay. Don't try to take my dopamine away.
It's not when we get someone on we really like, because normally we try to take everyone down by being like, let's see what.
How can we punish you today?
Yeah.
Well, anything else you want to promo or anything before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. Just Revolution 35 millimeter. I also have my own podcast called Eros Plus Massacre that focuses mostly on more obscure cinema, lots of East Asian stuff, but it's all over the place.
Couldn't recommend the latest episode more. I had a fucking blast.
Oh, thank you.
It's so good. It was so much fun. I was just mad it was not longer, and that has never happened listening to a podcast in my life.
Yeah, and it was 2 hours, but once we stopped recording, we were both like, but we didn't say this, and we didn't say this, and it's like, okay, dude, I have to edit this thing. Like, we could do a part two at some point, but we can't keep going right now. But I could talk about Rob Grier for, you know, the rest of my natural life.
He's great. He's the thinking man's pervert right there.
He is.
I didn't know this. I don't know if you know. Did you know Anne Hoy wrote her thesis on him when she was in college?
No, but holy shit, that checks out.
Yeah. Kind of blew my mind. Really?
Wow, good for her.
Yeah, I learned about her, the cooler she is always. She's that kind
of person.
Yeah. She's the shit. I will say, last night I showed Visible Secret at the Draft House, and there was someone there with a copy of Revolution in 35.
Was there really? Oh, that makes me so happy.
Sitting at the bar, yeah. And I was like, oh, I bet you're going to my screening. I bet you're not going to go to Christmas Vacation down the hall. So, which I want to say was very funny. I'll end on this note. We beat Christmas Vacation because there were 8 people in there, and it turned out to be an interactive viewing experience. So there were 8 people, and there was an MC being like, all right, and pausing the movie being like, it's an eggnog chugging.
No
one raised their hands. So he was like, who wants it? He was like, I'm gonna start picking people, and a Draft House guy had to come in and be like, you can't force the eggnog on people, my dude.
Hey, John, this will make you happy. I've never told you this because it's not one of the prouder moments of my life. Before I left Denver and moved to LA, I was so broke and I had been fired from multiple jobs that I took a job as that guy at the Draft House in Littleton. And my job was to dress as Buddy the Elf and do quote alongs with the kids. And then I would do Christmas Vacation with like drunk company parties and do that sort of thing. So I was that guy at the Draft House in like, what, fucking 2013?
Okay. Can you dress as Buddy the Elf for the secret screening on Thursday?
You joke, Sam, but you tell him that and he probably will do it.
Okay.
But
I actually love Elf. It's kind of embarrassing.
I genuinely do. And I also love to eat like Buddy. I used to put Pop-Tarts in my cereal. So.
Oh, God.
Yeah. This is something Sam and I have been talking about, is our sick love of Christmas movies.
I love Christmas movies. Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a Christmas episode.
Yeah. See, we're ending on a wholesome note. We went from rape and raping to Christmas. Also, oh, my God. Wait. Actually, hang on. There is, I don't know if either of you have it or have seen it, but there's a 2001 Pink film called Christmas Eve about a serial murder tracking people in the snow, and I must find it and see it. So it's by Toshiro Saiga. So if anyone knows it or has it, please send it to me. It will make my Christmas.
I'm going to do this live and see
it right here.
Okay, let's see.
I think I know where you can look, Will.
Yep.
It's not on A Vista Z. I could tell you that much.
Okay. Nope.
But it looks like it is elsewhere.
We are going to solve this right now. So let's make a list. What do we need to send Sam before she comes?
I've got it written down.
Colors. We got those.
Got the customs. And then
we cut none of this, by the way. This is a show we just run.
Okay, just send me all the Pink movies you have. Send me cloud. Unless that's, if that's streaming somewhere, you don't have to.
We're looking for it. Yet
in the fucking screener that we had, I feel so bad for John because he was like, yo, send me that cloud screener. And I sent it and he was like, hey, bitch, this is a dead link.
Oh, no.
I prepared. I got my tea. I had the day off. I had like my little gummy. I was like, here we go. We're going to get into cloud. And it was like, it's not working.
Not today. You're not.
No, we're not.
Okay, well, I'm gonna, this might take a minute because I'm gonna have to do all the different varying titles.
You know what, here's a funny thing we could do. We can end this episode and we can keep talking before Sam needs to go. So goodbye to everyone in pod world.
Bye. Thank you guys for having me and tolerating all of my Japanese pink film talk.
Oh, we love it. Thank you for joining us
today. Yeah, okay, bye everyone.